This is Live and Local. I'm Kevin Kelly. And on the program today, partly what we advertised, we will not be talking with the Julie Gratz of the Springfield Ballet. We were not able to connect on our interview this morning, and we'll probably schedule that for tomorrow or later in the week. We do have, however, for the hour, Patrick Ball, who is a Celtic harper and spoken word artist. He's going to be appearing at Heartland Gallery in downtown Urbana tonight at 7:30. And he drove up this morning from, or drove down, I guess, this morning from Evanston, where he was performing last night. And we have him in the studio with us, sharing some of his a compilation CD and telling a story or two. It's Live and Local on FM 90.9. Stay tuned. We heard Ensemble Galilei performing a couple of traditional Irish reels, one of them called My Love is in America, and Mother's Delight here on Live and Local on FM 90.9. And we're delighted to have with us in the studio Patrick Ball, who is a Celtic harper and spoken word artist, appearing at Heartland Gallery in downtown Urbana tonight at 7:30. And it's interesting, whenever you say Celtic harper, my first assumption was that you were Celtic. Of course, nobody calls themselves Celtic because there's so many Celtic lands, but you're in fact from California.
Well, actually, I live in California, but, you know, it's funny, I got an email a while ago somebody was complaining, they were saying, you can't call yourself a Celtic harper because you are not Celtic. And when actually my heritage and my genealogy is almost completely Irish, but I was born in San Francisco, and so I wrote back and I said, well, do I have to be French to play the French horn? And of course he never replied. Just another one of those emails you get from time to time.
So what it means is you play the Celtic harp.
Yes, exactly.
I mean, how else are you supposed to say that?
Exactly.
He is a player of the Celtic harp.
Yes, exactly.
That's harder to put on a CD.
Yeah, it is.
I think. So your website is actually a really interesting introduction for anybody who might like to know more about you after we have this conversation. I found it interesting because as somebody who tells stories, one assumes that a storyteller has some affinity for language and the use of language, and it was very quickly apparent just reading through the various pages, which I assume you wrote on your website.
Yes.
That here is somebody who loves language because you use it beautifully. Is that something that came naturally? You discovered early, or?
Well, no, it wasn't something I discovered early. You know, essentially what happened was I went to the University of California at Davis, which is in the Central Valley of California. And this is a little bit circuitous, but my father was a maritime lawyer, and he represented a couple of shipping companies from the Philippines. And when I was a junior in college, I got a free freighter ride from San Francisco all around the Far East for four or five months. And that was the very first time I ever wrote a letter home. And when I got to Manila for the second time, I found a letter from my father. And it was one of the very few letters he'd written to me. He was a very formal individual. And he said, I've received your letters, and I'd like to say that I'm very pleased that you're developing a certain facility with words, because, he said, words are like coins in a treasure chest. And I'd never heard anybody say anything like that before. And then I got back on the boat, sailed 2 months back to California, and about 3 months after that, my father died. But that letter stayed with me. And so when I got back through my senior year at the university, I began to search out words. I just sort of fell in love with words. And I even made my own dictionary of words of, which are onomatopoeia words, you know, words that say themselves. It was a short dictionary, needless to say, but the best thing about it is that I traded it to my roommate for his girlfriend. It was great. We both had a great time.
You traded it for his girlfriend?
Yes, I did. It was marvelous. And the girlfriend was infinitely more interesting and desirable than the dictionary I wrote. So anyway, that was my first thing. And then
he apparently didn't think so.
Well, he didn't complain. But anyway, I went to university. I began to seek out all these writers, like Irish writers have a certain facility with words. I don't know exactly what it is. I think what it was for so many centuries, Ireland lived in such poverty and such oppression, such dark times, that to them words were infinitely precious, because those were some of the few things that they had. They'd sit around the fire and the peat fire and tell stories and recite poetry and genealogies and things like that. And the extraordinary thing about these words, which I came to discover, was that it not only brought them a lot of joy and pleasure and comfort, but it reminded them of who they were as a people. And when they're being oppressed by the English for so many centuries, people often say that one of the reasons that they could never entirely be conquered was because they had this incredibly strong oral tradition. And this kind of embedded knowledge and sense of who they were was impossible to drive out of these people. And so they never entirely were subjugated, even though just about everything else but words and stories were taken away from them. So I ended up getting a master's degree in Irish history. And so I knew all about the times. But then when I began to read the writers and listen to the old storytellers, everything began to make sense. Historically and culturally, and then when I finished with the school, I had a master's degree. I had no job, or ever likelihood of ever getting a job. So I hitchhiked all across the country. I hitchhiked from San Francisco down to Los Angeles, and then I got one ride from Los Angeles all the way to the Blue Ridge Mountains in North Carolina, and it turned out my second cousin was the director of a very famous craft school up in the Blue Ridge Mountains. And his son, Jerry, did not apply himself in school. And so they said, would you like a job mowing the lawns for 6 weeks? And I said, sure. So he says, here's your boss. And the boss was a guy named Charlie Stevenson. He was ancient. Well, it seemed ancient then. I don't know if he's ancient now. But anyway, he was ancient. And he lived in the mountains all of his life. And they put us together about 8 o'clock in the morning. And our first job was to drive a bunch of bees out of the rain gutters in the dormitory. And so I'd never met this guy before. And he walks up to me, and this is what he said. He said, Pat, you're going to be the bee tester, and I'm going to be the bee getter. You're going to go up there and test and see if they'll sting. And if they'll sting, I'm going to get them. And he was just such a marvelous character that I just would sit around and listen to him talk all the time. And he had, you know, a different approach to words, but he had the same sort of thing. And I began to realize that so many people from, say, the Appalachian Mountains, places like that, came from Celtic places. And so they had the same sort of love and playfulness with the words. And so that's how I started getting involved in stories and travel and eventually into music as well.
Well, you know, since you do tell stories, I have to ask you, is everything you just said true?
A certain amount of it, yeah. No, actually, it is true. I mean, there's an awful lot that I say that is not true, but that essentially exactly happened as I said, yeah.
Because you know, you described it very well, and you described it as though you could have written it down, but some people are very good at formulating words that way. I loved the very first line that I read on your website. This was my introduction to Patrick Ball. Patrick Ball was born and raised in California and gave little thought to such things as where his ancestors came from. He went to school and supposed, when he thought about it at all, that he would one day be a lawyer like his father, which I just thought was wonderfully written. It had poetry to it almost,
thank you.
And it had rhythm. And, you know, I thought, here's somebody who knows how to write, if nothing else.
Well,
which was a nice introduction.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. Thank you.
Let's hear some music, and we'll certainly talk about that. But I should say that so that the people don't feel that they had the may have gotten the wrong impression, because I deliberately did not give them the wrong impression. We're going to be hearing from your CD, Weather Being What Weather Is. Your harp is next to you, but it's mostly just warming up or staying warm. And we'll talk about the vagaries of it, but let's just hear an introduction to your playing first. You sent me a CD, which is kind of a compilation of some of your favorites, I guess.
It's my greatest hits.
Music on the Wind. Go ahead and actually explain that title, because it's a wonderful it's a wonderful story behind that.
Well, the Music on the Wind, I guess the short version is... when I was, and this isn't all that short really, when I was in San Francisco, I was in this bar called The Plow and the Stars, and the band was playing. In fact, they were playing music that sounded very much like your intro music. And then they all took a break. And then this old guy went and sat on the stage, and the Plow and the Stars is a stage which is about three feet tall, and he just went, sort of sat on the edge of the stage, and he pulled out this tin whistle and he started to play, and nobody was paying any attention because he wasn't in front of the microphones. Everybody was playing pool and shouting and stuff, and but he played this tune which was so captivating and so beautiful that I was just stunned, because I didn't know that much about Irish music at the time. And so I walked over to him. I asked him where the tune came from. And he told me that it came from a place called the Blasket Islands. And the Blasket Islands are off the south coast of the county of Kerry. And in 1953, everybody from the Blasket Islands all moved away, because it was the old story of the islands. They couldn't make a living. Sorry, their turf was all played out, and big trawlers from Spain and England and France essentially played out all the fish in the ocean. So they all moved away. And so I said, well, where would I hear this tune? And he said, the people on the Blasket Islands used to hear it on the wind. Nobody composed it, nobody wrote it down, but if you listened hard enough on one of the outer islands, you would hear this music floating over the islands, and people knew it, and eventually they played it, and it came to the mainland, and people began to know it. And so that's kind of like... a little version of a story which is heard all around Ireland, that the music from the other world, the music of the fairies, is accessible to us as music on the wind. And that's, they believe, where all the music in the world came from. In Ireland, they used to believe that nobody really composed anything. But if you happen to have the power, you could hear music from the other worlds, and it was given to you as a gift by the fairy people, or by the gentle people, the good people. So that's makes a lot of sense to me. And sometimes I do these school shows, and I always ask the kids, you know, where they think melodies come from, where compositions come from, and they find that to be a very reasonable explanation, because you know, now when you're an adult, you don't really think about where something comes from when it pops into your head, but the Irish people believe that it came from the other world. So that's Music on the Wind.
Music on the Wind. And here is one such tune. It's is the first tune on the CD, called The Butterfly. Patrick Ball playing the Celtic harp on Live and Local. Thank you. Patrick Ball playing the Celtic harp, a tune called The Butterfly from his CD called Music on the Wind, Selected Pieces, 1983 to 2003. And you don't credit that one with a composer. So is that one of those that
you heard
on the wind? Or somebody heard on the wind and just wrote it down?
I probably heard it on somebody's recording. Actually, it's a really common, I mean, it's a really well-known tune. Just about everybody has played it in one form or another, and I loved it. So to my knowledge, it was a traditional song. But there's always somebody who's going to phone in and tell you that their cousin wrote it, so...
And then we may or may not believe them.
Yeah, exactly.
You were talking about, first, this is Live and Local on FM 90.9. I'm Kevin Kelly. My guest for this hour is Patrick Ball, and he's going to be appearing at the Heartland Gallery downtown Urbana tonight from 7:30 and playing the harp and telling some stories. Or you, your website says spoken word. You don't, on your website anyway, call yourself a storyteller. Is there a reason for that?
Yeah, well, I only because my shows have a lot of stories, but there's also some solo theater pieces, and there are literary pieces and things like that, which are not strictly storytelling. So I just use the term spoken word to cover a variety of things, whereas storytelling. Generally, when people hear that you're a storyteller, they generally assume that you're telling, traditional stories or things like that. So I just sort of broadened the scope of the terminology.
Do I remember reading on there that one of your shows is to read some of Finnegan's Wake?
yeah, I did actually. What happened was the guy who ran the record company, who still does run the record company, then with Celestial Harmonies. He was in Munich, and he was listening to the radio someplace, and he heard John Cage reading Finnegan's Wake in his kitchen. And so he decided that it would be a really good idea for me to record some of Finnegan's Wake. And so I did. I had to pick out the easiest bits of all, because as anybody that knows Finnegan's Wake knows, it's completely impenetrable. It's really, really difficult. But it turned out to be a really wonderful, wonderful experience, because he had to really, really come to grips with what he was trying to say. And I had to read lots and lots of books just to find out what it is he was saying, because he would invent his own words. And the breadth of James Joyce's knowledge was just astonishing. And it turned out to be, it was almost like one of those Dan Brown novels where, you know, you read this thing and suddenly there's a sudden twist and everything kind of makes sense. And with James Joyce... what you hear when it's spoken out loud, there are meanings that emerge from the sound, not just for the intellectual meaning of the words. The sound of the words give it a whole different set of layers to the thing. And and he was so steeped in things like sort of accents and nuances and things like that, that he would deliberately spell something in a way which would suggest two or three different meanings. I mean, you knew more or less the first meaning, but then when you spoke it out loud, it would come out as an accent, the way somebody, say, from, you know, County Clare would say it, and then suddenly there would be two different meanings. I'm sorry I didn't bring a copy of the recording, because... we could have played it, but I don't do that in concert, because it's just too baffling for just about everybody.
Well, I would think so. I mean, yeah. I've read, enough of Finnegan's Wake to know that I didn't want to read Finnegan's Wake.
Well, occasionally I have it at concerts, and I have to always tell the record salesperson that, you have to be sure to tell anybody that's thinking about buying this to what they're getting, because, anybody that doesn't know what it is, they'll listen to the first 30 seconds, and they'll just think they just, fell into an insane asylum someplace. And so I have to be careful about that.
Yeah, it's a lot of work. It's a lot of work to try to
penetrate
that. You earlier imitated this guy that you used to work with from, was it North Carolina?
Yeah.
And at least some of your shows, you do use an Irish brogue. as we said earlier, and as people can hear, you're not from Ireland.
No,
you're from California. But and it was a rather nice one. Did you discover at some point that you happen to have an ear for people's speech, that you're able to pick this up?
Well, I don't know. I guess I do to some extent. But, I mean, I know people who are infinitely better at it than I am. But
because that was wonderful when you were – I mean, I don't know what your friend actually sounded like, but I was totally I could have believed totally that that's exactly what he sounded
like. Well, he
like.
Sounded pretty much like yeah. that. And, you know, and I worked with him just about every day for a year and a half. And it's one of those things where anybody that has a colorful way of speaking, like people from the South or – you know, any place where people have a strong regional dialect, if you go there and you talk like you and I, the person from that area is not going to start talking like you, but we're going to start talking like them, because there's much, much more music and much more appeal and seduction in the way that they're talking. It's a very musical thing to listen to. And
and yet not everybody can do it. You know, bring it back. They think they're doing it, but they're not.
Yeah,
you were.
Well, yeah. I travel around a lot by myself, so I guess to amuse myself, I think up things. But one of the problems with Irish accents is that there's so many different Irish accents. And when I first started to try to learn some of these dialects and accents. Somebody said, well, you don't have to really worry about all that, because Brendan Behan once said that there's only two real Irish accents. There is what he called standard Irish, and there is toothless Irish. And so I was more of a practitioner of the toothless variety. But the problem is, one of the problems is that the more authentic you get with an Irish accent, particularly different sort of places like down in Kerry or other places, or parts of Dublin, that kind of thing. If people in this country can understand you, it's probably not very accurate, because a lot of the accents that you would hear over there are so strong, and people tend to talk relatively fast in urban situations, and it's really hard. I remember the first time I went to Scotland. In fact, I went to Scotland when I left North Carolina, and I got this flight. Out of New York City, I found this travel agent, and he said, "I can give you a flight from, LaGuardia over to Scotland for $50." He says, "What do you look like?" And I said, "Well,
what do you look like?"
Yeah, he says, "What do you look like?" And I said, "Well, I kind of described myself." He says, "Okay, meet me behind the third column of the KLM terminal, and I'll give you your ticket." And so I met this really shady-looking guy, and he gave me this ticket, and he says, "If anybody asks you about it, you're a last-minute name change." And so I got my ticket, and it turned out I was on a I was on a flight full of golfers going to Scotland, and I was the only person on the plane that was not wearing plaid pants. So they pretty much knew that I wasn't one of their people. But anyway, they dumped me off in this place called Prestwick Airport in Scotland, and I started hitchhiking around, and this guy picks me up in a pickup truck, or their version of a pickup truck, and he drove me, I don't know, someplace for about a half an hour, and he talked the whole time, and I did not understand one word the whole time, and I just felt so embarrassed, because he was, you know, he was speaking English, and I just felt, you know, pretty incompetent. But anyway, it's only when you stay over there for a while that you begin to get the melody of the speech, and then once you have the melody, it kind of helps to learn an accent. I mean, I actually went one time. I used to live in London, and I went to this place called the London Academy of Music and Dramatic Art to talk to their dialect guy, and he taught me the phonetic alphabet. And so every single word that the human body, human, you know, mouth and tongue and such like things can say has its own symbol, and it's the dialect, the alphabet creates these symbols by juxtaposing the symbols like the alphabet that we have. And so if you know how to read it and you know all the indications, whatever comes out of your mouth will be the accent that you're trying to say, even though you don't know what you're doing in terms of, you know, you don't have a real strong grasp of the accent.
If you read it from the phonetic
exactly.
symbols.
Yeah. And I found it virtually useless. I found it really, really fascinating, but it didn't really help me too much because it was so, you had to think about it so much. So when I was in London, I used to spend a whole lot of time, particularly in the bars of Kilburn up in north, one of the ends of London where the Irish people tended to congregate. And back in those days, Ireland was still very poor. And so the vast majority of the people that lived in Kilburn were there for economic reasons, and therefore they didn't really want to be there, but they had to be there. And so it was a great place to talk to people because they were kind of homesick, and since they were over there and away from their country, I think they valued what they had left behind even more. And so they were very generous and open in telling stories and playing music. We used to play on Sundays after Mass in these pubs, and I learned an awful lot of accents and dialects that way. But still, I have one show where there's a guy from Dublin, and I found it really, really hard to do because...
A character is from...
The character is from Dublin.
The show is from Dublin.
Yeah, and it was very, very hard to do because there's a lot of different dialects, different accents in Dublin, but it's also... it's very dense and very fast. And so what I used to do is I used to watch movies if I wasn't over there, or when I was over there, watch these movies. And... a lot of those Irish movies, there's people from all around Ireland in the films, but there was a great movie called The General. And The General is about a guy named Martin Cahill, or Kyle, who was a crime lord, you know, a very famous crime, sort of like a, you know, one of the leaders of a certain crime gang in Dublin. And everybody in his gang lived on the same street because they didn't trust anybody. So they all talked exactly the same. So it was really handy to be able to watch a movie where everybody talked exactly in the same accent. It was very helpful.
So We're talking with Patrick Ball here on Live and Local. He is a spoken word artist and practitioner of the Celtic harp, and he'll be practicing both at the Heartland Gallery downtown Urbana tonight at 7:30. Support for our program comes in part from Lincoln Square Village, who, along with the Urbana Business Association, present the Lincoln Square Village Holiday Market Saturdays from 8 a.m. to 1 p.m., now through December 19th, with homegrown produce, baked goods, holiday plants, crafts, and more, located inside Lincoln Square Village in downtown Urbana. Information is at 344-3872 or at urbanabusiness.com. I want to play for our listeners another sample from your disc called Music on the Wind. I thought this was just beautiful. It's one of the numerous tunes you have here from Turlough O'Carolan, or Turlough, I'll let you say it a little later. This is a tune called Blind Mary, and then I want to ask you about Carillon as bard, and that's relationship to your harp on Live and Local. Thank you. a tune by Carillon called Blind Mary from Patrick Ball's CD called Music on the Wind. His selected pieces over the two decades, 1983 to 2003. Carillon was a, you describe him, he's often described as the last of the Irish bards. What did the bards do? And then how does that relate to the harp that you play on this recording and that you play now? Same harp.
Well, the term the last of the Irish bards is a little bit misleading in terms of Turlough O'Carolan, because he really wasn't strictly a bard. To be probably as accurate as I could be, back in the earlier times in Ireland, there were three types of performers for the most part. There were poets who composed poetry, but they were far too cool to recite it themselves. And so the bard did the recitations and told some stories back in the earlier times. And then very distinct from them were the harp players. And the harp players very highly honored back in those times as opposed to now. And so there were bards, poets, and harp players. And then once the English came and really got their mitts into Ireland, what they did the sensible thing as oppressors. They got rid of as many of the symbols of the culture as they could, and they broke down the system, the what they call the bardic system. They got rid of all the kings and the chieftains and replaced them with people of their own people. And then things changed. Poets didn't have a whole, you know, as much sway over the culture, and the bards and the poets sometimes merged their talents. And so from that time forward, oftentimes whoever was playing the harp would also be the person that was reciting stories or poetry or genealogies or things like that. So Turlough O'Carolan was not really a bard at all, because he mostly simply composed pieces of music, but he also wrote lyrics to the pieces. So there's a certain grain of truth to him being a bard. But just so people know, if they've never heard of Turlough O'Carolan, he was born in 1670 and died in 1738. And back in those times in Ireland, they had what was called the penal laws. And the penal laws were instituted by the English to wreak as much havoc upon the Irish people as possible. And among the things that they did was they took away almost all their civil rights. They could not own a horse worth more than £5. They could not own any weapons. It was essentially a garrisoned country. It was a very bleak, dark, miserable time for most Irish, particularly Irish Catholic people. And another thing that they used to do, and this may be more than you want to know, but if you had a big estate, if you were sort of like Irish aristocracy, such as it was, you used to give your land and all your land to your eldest son, which is not entirely equitable, but that's the way it was. And it was a good thing to do because it kept your estate intact. But what they did is they said, well, when you die, you cannot give your land to one person. It has to be divided up equally between all of your offspring. And the upshot of that was that every generation, your land would be divided into smaller pieces, so you would no longer be aristocracy, no longer be landed gentry. You would be peasantry. And so the whole structure of the Irish society was completely changed and destroyed. Well, that's when Turlough O'Carolan lived. And so he lived in a very, very dark time. Also, when he was about 14 or 15, he got smallpox, and he was left completely blind for the rest of his life. And so he had these two really sort of catastrophic situations to live in, the darkness of his time and the darkness of his own loss of his sight. And yet he began to write music, which was so beautiful and so uplifting and so inspiring to his countrymen and countrywomen, that I began to be really fascinated. When I studied history, I knew the time that he lived in, and then I ran across his music, and it was so beautiful that I couldn't figure out how somebody had the strength of character and the, you know, sort of the spiritual strength to compose beautiful, uplifting things in the face of all this, all these deprivations and difficulties. And so eventually I wrote a piece about him, a theater piece about him, in which his music is featured and that his life and times are explained. And his harp is exactly like the harp that I play. This harp is called a Celtic harp. And the word Celtic harp is bandied about a little bit because these wire-strung, brass-strung Celtic harps like mine died out about 200 years ago. Nobody played them from that time forward. But they did not eliminate harps. They switched harps with gut or nylon strings. Now they use nylon strings for the most part. But the harp that O'Carolan played was just like what you've been hearing when you've been playing a cut of mine. And just so people know, it's about 4.5 feet tall. It's made of maple wood, and it's got 32 brass strings, which you play with your fingernails. And
which is itself different from what most people do now.
Yeah, very different. Yeah, most harps are played with nylon strings or gut strings, which are played with your finger pads. And the extraordinary thing about O'Carolan was, as you say, he really was not strictly a bard, but he was the last of the people to carry on the harp playing tradition. And you know, it's funny. You've had a lot of Irish musicians in here before, and occasionally people say, well, you know, O'Carolan's not really, traditional Irish music. And they're exactly right. He was a composer. He wrote, I guess, what would be called art music. But he also wrote music. The compositions that he wrote harken back to the really old style of harp playing, which died out and was lost. But he also was influenced by the time that he lived in. A lot of people from Italy, playing Corelli and Vivaldi and people like that, started to come to Ireland, and he would perform in these rich people's houses. He would have his harp and his horse, and he would ride from house to house, and he'd perform for these people. And occasionally he'd run into people probably playing the violin or maybe the flute or something like that, playing this Italian music. And he just adored this music for some reason. And so his compositions are a combination of ancient Irish harp playing, Italian Baroque music, and his own genius, I guess you'd say. So it's not strictly folk music, but he became so beloved and so honored that his face was on the 50-pound note in Ireland all the years that they had the pound notes. And now they don't, of course, because they've switched to the euro. But anyway, his harp and his position in society harken back to the bardic times, back when they would travel from place to place. And play a harp like this.
And you're picking up directly on that tradition. Yeah. Here's here's another tune of his, and then I want you to tell us a story.
Sure.
This is called, I love the title. This is, I picked this more for the title than the music, although I like the music also. It's called Carolan's Quarrel with the Landlady.
Ah, good
Patrick
tune.
Harp playing the Celtic, Patrick Ball playing the Celtic harp here on Live and Local. Thank you. Carolan's Quarrel with the Landlady by Turlough O'Carolan, played on the Celtic harp by Patrick Ball. And those brass strings and playing with the fingernails gives them that. It sounds like you're playing with a set of bells.
Well, you know, it's funny you should say that, because that's what they used to say. They used to say that it sounded like the pealing of bells, and it really does. It's the most amazing. I remember the first time that I heard it, I was thoroughly gobsmacked by it, and not everybody is, but I don't know whether it's in your DNA or something, but there's something which is so powerful about this instrument to me that the very first time I heard it, I just was astonished and immediately wanted to play it, and so I did, and that's what brought me here.
That's beautiful sound, beautiful playing, and you are here in our studio in Urbana in advance of your performance tonight at Heartland Gallery in downtown Urbana. That's going to start at 7:30. And I understand there are still seats available. It's a small space, so they recommend you call area 217-337-4767. Again, that's 217-337-4767. It's going to be a combination of harp playing and telling a tale or two, including perhaps one for our listeners now.
Yeah, well, what I think I should do is people should be warned that these stories come in various lengths. And I thought, since our time is running short, I'll just tell you the very first story I ever heard any Irish person tell me. As I said before, I used to live in London, and my wife is English, but her ancestry is Irish. And so just about every night of the year, every weekend of the year, she'd have a big party, and she knew all these Irish musicians. In fact, the guy that played the fiddle on Lord of the Rings and the solo, Dermot Crean, he used to come and play with us all the time. And anyway, one night, it must have been about midnight or 1 o'clock or so, something, everyone's flailing away, and suddenly there's this knock on the door, and somebody opens the door, and there's this ancient, cadaverous-looking guy. And he's standing there in the light cast from the living room. And it's like one of those Western movies where all the music stops and all the talking stops, and somebody says, "Jeez, that's Packy Byrne. He's a great storyteller." And so Packy comes in, and everybody starts to play again. And Packy sits down, has a drink. And after a while, I walked over and I said, "Packy, can you tell me one of your stories?" And I'll never forget what he said, because these words sort of changed my life. And he said, "I can't tell you one now, but I'll tell you one later." So, as it turned out, 1 year to the day later, he told me this story. There were these two brothers living in a backward part of the countryside where I grew a man, in the county of Donegal, and they were farmers, the both of them. And one of these fellows wore out his shoes, and so they went into the cobbler store in the village, and there in the window was a great big pair of shoes with a sign in front that said £95. And the brother said, "Faith, that seems like a lot of money to pay for a pair of shoes." And so they went into the cobbler. They said, "Why are them shoes there at £95? And the cobbler says, "Well, no, boys, those are very special shoes. Those are alligator shoes. Those are alligator shoes. And they come all the way from the Nile River." And so the brothers went back outside. They said, "Do you know what? If we were to go to the Nile and come back with some of them things, we could make a fortune." So after consulting with the parish priest, they found out where the Nile was. And so they got on board a great big steamer going out of Cork City, and they sailed off down the Atlantic, got about to the Rock of Gibraltar. They made a hard left, went into the Mediterranean Sea, got off at Egypt, and started walking south down the Nile, and nobody saw these fellas again for about 2 years. Well, at last, the parish priest decided he had to have a search party to go and find them. So he gathered up all the able-bodied men in the village. There was two.
and they sailed off down the Atlantic, got about to the rock of Gibraltar, made a hard left, went into the Mediterranean Sea, got off at Egypt, and started walking south down the Nile. Now, says Packy Byrne, he says, I don't know how many of you have been to the Nile, but I'm telling you now, there are no straight parts. It's all filled with the twists and the turns. And as the search party went down the Nile, every time they came under a twist or a turn, what would they find on the side of the Nile but a dead alligator, but no brothers. Well, they got about halfway down, and if you'd been there, you'd recognise the place because it's the biggest turn to the right. And there on the side of the Nile is this bloody great stack of dead alligators, and one of the lost brothers, he's leaning against this pile of alligators, and he's smoking away in a cigarette, and he's looking out into the middle of the Nile. Now, says Packy, I don't know how many of you have been to that part of the Nile, but I'm telling you now, if you're standing in the middle, it's only about up to your waist or so. And there in the middle of the Nile is the other lost brother, and he's got this whacking great alligator around the waist, and he's wrestling with this bugger. And finally he heaves him up on the shore and says, well, bejabers, if there's no shoes on the next one, I'm going home.
Okay. Didn't know where it was going, but that was a good place to go.
You're wondering, when is this going to be over?
That's a good story.
Oh, thank you very much. Well, it's just a little funny story, but it was the very first story I ever ran across. And Packy Byrne was a very famous folk performer. He came from Donegal, and he moved to England. He was a drover when he was growing up in Ireland, and he moved to London, and he became a real beloved figure on the folk circuit. He told stories and sang, and he played the tin whistle. He was marvelous. A marvelous character, and eventually he moved back to Donegal, but everybody adored this person, and he was my first introduction to, you know, the marvels of Irish storytelling.
And your inspiration for doing what you're doing.
Yeah.
Or an inspiration for doing what you're doing. We're talking with Patrick Ball, who is a spoken word artist, and Celtic Harper. He's going to be at Heartland Gallery this evening, 7:30, that's in downtown Urbana, and they do have some seats available for that, some tickets available. I don't know that you actually need tickets, but you do need to make a reservation and pay to be there. And we're going to have one more tune in just a moment from your CD called Music on the Wind, and a note to Mike Pritchard, our sound engineer. We're going to skip to track 18 on that disc, which has a wonderful title of The Twisting of the Rope. And this is another one uncredited. So I guess this is not the one heard on the wind, presumably traditional tune.
No, this was written by Dick Cheney.
Thank you.
Patrick Ball, a tune called The Twisting of the Rope on his CD called Music of Music on the Wind, selected pieces 1983 to 2003. If you'd like more information on Patrick Ball, he does have a website, and it's rather wonderful. It's simply patrickball.com. And information on his various shows. You can see pictures of his wonderful harp. You can hear some sound samples, both of the playing and of the speaking, and even a few video clips on there. And of course, you can see him perform live tonight at Heartland Gallery downtown Urbana. Starts at 7:30. The phone number for reservations is area 217-337-4767. And I really appreciate your taking the time to actually getting up earlier than you otherwise would have, drive down here from Evanston. You performed there last night, I guess.
Yeah, I did. Well, it was a pleasure. I'm really glad to have been here. Thank you.
And I appreciated the stories, both the one that was a story, and the other stories that you told us about your own experiences.
Well, it was a pleasure. Yeah, I doing what I do, you run into an awful lot of really interesting people. So. It's a really nice chance for me to revisit all those people that sort of helped me on my way. So it was a real nice being here.
And you're one of the many interesting people I've met during this show, and our listeners have had the experience of doing as well. So
thanks
very much. Patrick Ball here on Live and Local on FM 90.9. Our broadcast is made possible with support from these business partners, EAG Company Incorporated of Fairmount, Family Video Movie Club of Springfield, First National Bank and Trust Company of Clinton, and Jarman Center of Tuscola. These business partners join the Friends of WYLL in making great programs possible, and we thank you. Here are some of the other events going on in our area tonight and tomorrow. It's the Millikan University Monday Night Jazz at Lock, Stock, and Barrel in Decatur at 6 o'clock and at 7 o'clock. This afternoon, a little later on, guest masterclass by soprano Elizabeth Futral at the Music Building Auditorium on the campus of the University of Illinois in Urbana. That's at 3:30 this afternoon. Also at the U of I, the Illini Symphony is performing tonight at 7:30 at Smith Recital Hall. And then tomorrow at 8 o'clock, the Millikan University Children's Choir Concert at Kuiper Hall at Perkinson Music Center. That's at 5:30 tomorrow. This is Live and Local. I'm Kevin Kelly.